I have never been successful at doing this at home. But this crisis had forced a change. Compartmentalizing wasn't a question of desire as much as survival. To get emotional, to allow myself to wallow in doubt or consider the implications of a child missing for 18 months, it would paralyze me. That was probably what the kidnappers wanted. They wanted me to come apart. But I work well under pressure. I am at my best. I know that. I had to do that now. The walls came up. I could look at the situation rationally. First thing, no, I would not contact the police this time. But that did not mean I had to wait around helplessly. By the time Edgar handed me the duffel bag stuffed with money, I had an idea. I called Cheryl in Lenny's house. There was no answer. I checked my watch. 8:15 in the morning. I didn't have Cheryl's cell phone, but it would be better to do this in person anyway. I drove over to Willard Elementary School and arrived at 8:25. I parked behind a line of SUVs and minivans and got out. This elementary school, like so many others, has the bricks, the cement back steps, the one level, the architectural design made shapeless by the many additions. Some additions try to blend in, but then there are the others, usually built between 1968 and 1975, that were faux sleek with blue glass and odd tiling. They looked like post-apocalyptic greenhouses. Kids scrambled around the playground, as they always do. The difference was the parents now stayed and watched. They chatted with one another, and when the bell rang, they made sure that their charges were safely ensconced inside the brick or sleek blue glass before departing. I hated to see the fear in the eyes of the parents, but I understood it. The day you become a parent, fear becomes your constant companion. It never lets you go. My life was Exhibit A in the Y. Cheryl's blue Chevy Suburban pulled into the drop-off line. I started toward her. She was unharnessing Justin from his car seat when she spotted me. Justin gave her a dutiful kiss, an act he takes for granted, which I guess is how it should be. And then he ran off. Cheryl watched him as though afraid he could vanish on the short concrete trek. Kids can never understand that fear, but that's okay. Hard enough to be a kid without having that weight on you. Hey, Cheryl said to me. I said hi back. Then, I need something. What? Rachel's phone number. Cheryl was already back at the driver's side door. Get in. My car is parked over there. I'll bring you back. Swim practice ran late. I gotta get Marianne to school. She had already started the car. I hopped up into the front passenger seat. I turned and smiled at Marianne. She wore headphones and quick-fingered her Game Boy Advanced. She gave me an absent-minded wave, barely glancing up. Her hair was still wet. Connor was in the child seat next to her. The car reeked of chlorine, but I found the smell oddly comforting. Lenny, I know, cleans out the car religiously, but you can't possibly keep up. There were French fries in the crevice between the seats. Crumbs of unknown origin clung to the upholstery. On the floor by my feet lay a potpourri of school notices and children's artwork that had been subjected to onslaughts of rain boots. I sat on a small action figure, the kind that McDonald's gives away with their Happy Meals. A CD case reading Now That's What I Call Music 14 sat between us, providing listeners with the latest from Britney and Christina and generic boy band. The windows in the back were smeared with greasy fingerprints. The kids were only allowed to play with the Game Boy in the car, never in the house. They were never, under any circumstance, allowed to watch a PG-13 movie. I asked Lenny about how he and Cheryl went about deciding such matters, and he responded, "It's not the rules themselves, but the fact that there are rules." I think I know what he meant. Cheryl kept her eyes on the road. It's not my nature to pry. But you want to know my intentions.
I guess.
And if I don't want to tell you?
Maybe, she said, it's better if you don't.
Trust me here, Cheryl. I need the number.
She flipped on her signal light.
Rachel is still my closest friend.
Okay.
It took her a long time to get over you.
She hesitated.
And vice versa.
Exactly.
Look, I'm not saying this right. It's just, there are some things you need to know.
Like?
She kept her eyes on the road, two hands on the wheel. You asked Lenny why we never told you she got divorced.
Yes.
Cheryl glanced in the rearview mirror, not at the road, but at her daughter. Marianne seemed wrapped up in her game.
She didn't get divorced. Her husband is dead.
Cheryl glided to a stop in front of the middle school. Marianne took off the headphones and slid out. She did not bother with a dutiful kiss, but she did say goodbye. Cheryl put the car back in drive.
I'm sorry to hear that, I said, because that was what people said under these circumstances.
I almost added, because the mind works in very strange and even macabre ways. Hey, Rachel and I have something else in common. And then, as if Cheryl could read these thoughts, she said, he was shot.
This eerie parallel sat between us for several seconds. I stayed quiet.
I don't know the details, she quickly added. He was with the FBI, too. Rachel was one of the highest-ranking women in the Bureau at the time. She resigned after he died. She stopped taking my calls. It hasn't been good for her since.
Cheryl pulled up to my car and stopped.
I'm telling you this because I want you to understand. A lot of years have passed since college. Rachel isn't the same person you loved all those years ago.
I kept my tone steady. I just need her phone number. Without another word, Cheryl grabbed a pen from the visor, uncapped it with her teeth, and jotted the number on a Dunkin' Donuts napkin.
Thanks, I said.
She barely nodded as I got out. I did not hesitate. I had my cell phone. I slipped into my car and dialed the number. Rachel answered with a tentative hello. My words were simple enough. I need your help.
Chapter 14. 5 hours later, Rachel's train pulled into Newark Station. I couldn't help but think of all those old movies where trains separate lovers, steam billowing from beneath, the conductor calling a last warning, the whistle sounding, the chug-chug as the wheels begin to move, one lover hanging out and waving, the other running along the platform. I don't know why I thought of this. The Newark train station is about as romantic as a pile of hippo dung with head lice. The train approached with nary a whisper and nothing you'd want to see or smell wafted in the air. But when Rachel stepped off, I still felt the hum in my chest. She was dressed in faded blue jeans and a red turtleneck. Her overnight bag dangled from one shoulder and she hoisted it up as she stepped down. For a moment, I just stared. I'd just turned 36 years old. Rachel was 35. We had not been together since our very early 20s. We had lived our entire adult lives apart. Odd when you think of it that way. I told you before about our breakup. I try to unearth the whys, but maybe it is that simple. We were kids. Kids do dumb things. Kids don't understand repercussions.
don't think long term. Kids don't understand that the hum may never really leave your chest. Yet today, when I realized that I needed help, I thought first of Rachel. And she had come. She moved toward me with no hesitation. You okay? Fine. Did they call? Not yet. She nodded and started walking down the platform. Her tone was no nonsense. She, too, had slipped into her role as a professional. Tell me more about the DNA test. I don't know anything else. So it's not definitive? Not court evidence definitive, no, but they seem pretty sure. Rachel shifted her bag from her right shoulder to her left. I tried to keep up with her pace. We have to make some tough decisions, Mark. You ready for that? Yes. First off, are you certain that you don't want to contact the cops or FBI? The note said they had an inside source. That's probably bull, she said. We walked a few more steps. I contacted the authorities last time, I said. Doesn't mean it was the wrong move. But it certainly wasn't the right one. She made a yes-no gesture with her head. You don't know what happened last time. Maybe they spotted the tail. Maybe they watched your house. But most likely they never intended to give her back. You understand that? Yes. But you still want them left out? It's why I called you. She nodded and finally stopped, waiting for me to signal which way. I pointed to the right. She started up again. Another thing, she said. What? We can't let them dictate the tempo this time. We have to insist on assurances that Tara is alive. They'll say the hairs prove it. And we'll say the tests were inconclusive. You think they'll buy that? I don't know. Probably not. She kept walking, the cut of her jaw held high. But this is what I mean by tough decisions. That flannel shirt guy in the park, that's about head games. They want to intimidate and weaken you. They want you to follow blindly again. Tara is your child. If you want to just hand over the money again, that's up to you. But I wouldn't advise it. They vanished before. There's no reason to think they won't again. We entered the parking garage. I handed the attendant my ticket. So what do you suggest? I asked her. A few things. First, we have to demand an exchange. No, here's the money, call us later. We get your daughter when they get the money. And if they don't agree? She looked at me with those eyes. Tough decisions. You understand? I nodded. I also want a total electronic surveillance hookup so I can stay with you. I want to strap on a fiber optic camera and see what this guy looks like if possible. We don't have manpower, but there are still things we can do. Suppose they catch on. Suppose they run away again, she countered. We're taking chances here no matter what we do. I'm trying to learn from what happened the first time. There are no guarantees. I'm simply trying to improve our odds. The car arrived. We slid in and started up MacArthur Highway. Rachel suddenly grew very quiet. The years, again, melted away. I knew this posture. I had seen it before. What else? I said. Nothing. Rachel. Something in my tone made her look away. There are some things you should know. I waited. I called Cheryl, she said. I know she filled you in on most of it. You understand that I'm not a Fed anymore. Yes. There's a limit to what I can do. I understand that. She sat back. The posture was still there. What else? You need a reality check here, Mark. We pulled to a red light. I turned and looked at her. Really looked at her for the first time. The eyes still had that hazel with gold flakes. I know the years had been tough, but it didn't show in the eyes. The odds that Tara is still alive are minuscule, she said. But the DNA test, I countered. I'll handle that later. Handle it? Later, she said again. What the hell does that mean? It's a match. Edgar said the final confirmation is a formality. Later, she repeated with steel in her voice. Right now, we might as well assume that she's alive. We should go through with the ransom drop-off as if there is a healthy child on the other end. But somewhere along the line, I need you to understand that this could be an elaborate con. How do you figure? That's not relevant. Like hell it isn't. Are you saying, what, they faked a DNA test? I doubt it. Then she added, but it's a possibility. How? There was a match between the two sets of hairs. The hairs matched each other. Yes. But, she said, how do you know the first set of hairs, the ones you got a year and a half ago, belonged to Tara? It took a few moments for the meaning to reach me. Did you ever run a test on the first set, see if the DNA matched yours? She asked. Why would we? So for all you know, the original kidnappers sent you the hairs of another kid. I tried to shake my head clear. But they had a snippet of her clothes, I said. The pink with black penguins. How do you explain that? You don't think the Gap sold more than one of those? Look, I don't know what the story is yet, so let's not get bogged down in hypotheticals. Let's just concentrate on what we can do here and now. I sat back. We fell into silence. I wondered if I had made the right move by calling her. There was so much excess baggage here. But at the end of the day, I trusted her. We needed to maintain the professional, to keep compartmentalizing. I just want my daughter back, I said. Rachel nodded, opened her mouth as if to say something, and then grew silent again. And that was when the ransom call came in. Chapter 15. Lydia liked to stare at old photographs. She did not know why. They offered her little comfort. The nostalgia factor was, at best, limited. Heshy never looked back. For reasons that she could never properly articulate, Lydia did. This particular photograph had been taken when Lydia was 8 years old. It was a black-and-white still from the beloved classic TV sitcom Family Laughs. The show ran for 7 years. In Lydia's case, from the age of 6 until just near her 13th birthday. Family Laughs starred ex-movie hunk Clive Wilkins as the widowed father of 3 adorable children. Twin boys, Todd and Rod, who were 11 when the series began, and an adorable pixie of a little sister named, cutely enough, Trixie, played by the irrepressible Larissa Dane. Yes, the show was at least 3 steps beyond precious. Old repeats of Family Laughs still run on TV Land. Every once in a while, the E! True Hollywood Story runs a piece on the old cast of Family Laughs. Clive Wilkins died from pancreatic cancer 2 years after the show ended. The narrator would note that Clive was just like a father on the set, which Lydia knew was a load of crap. The guy drank and smelled like tobacco. When she hugged him for the cameras, it took all her considerable young acting skills not to gag from the stench. Jared and Stan Frank, the real-life identical twins who played Todd and Rod, had been trying to get a music career going since the show's cancellation. On Family Laughs, they had a groovy garage band with a repertoire of songs written by others, instruments played by others, and voices so echoed and distorted by synthesizers that even Jared and Stan, who could not hold a key if it was tattooed into their palms, started to believe that they were genuine musical artistes. The twins were both nearing 40 now, both clearly clients of the hair club, both deluding themselves that even though they claimed to be tired of the fame, they were one break away from the return to stardom. But the true draw here, the gripping enigma of the Family Laughs saga, involved the fate of the adorable pixie named Trixie, Larissa Dane. Here is what is known about her. During the show's final season, Larissa's parents got divorced and fought bitterly over her earnings. Her dad ended up blowing his brains out. Her mother remarried a con artist who disappeared with the money. Like most child actors, Larissa Dane became an immediate has-been. Rumors of promiscuity and drug abuse swirled, though this being before the nostalgia craze, no one really cared enough to be interested. She overdosed and nearly died when she was just 15. She was sent to a sanitarium of some sort and seemingly dropped off the face of the earth. No one really knows what became of her. Many believe that she died from a second drug overdose. But of course, she had not. Heshy said, "You ready to make the call, Lydia?" She did not answer right away. Lydia moved to the next photograph. Another shot from Family Laughs, this time Season 5, Episode 112. Little Trixie wore a cast on her arm. Todd wanted to draw a guitar on it. Father didn't really approve. Todd protested, "But Dad, I promise only to draw it, not play it." The laugh track howled. Young Larissa didn't understand the joke. Grown-up Lydia didn't either. What she did remember, however, was how she had broken her arm that day. Typical kid stuff, really. She was horsing around and fell down the stairs. The pain was tremendous, but they needed to get this show in the can. With that in mind, the studio doctor shot her up with Lord knows what, and two hack screenwriters incorporated the injury into the script. She was barely conscious when they filmed. But please, do not start up the violins. Lydia had read Danny Partridge's book. She had listened to the whining of Willis on Different Strokes. She had heard all about the plight of the child star, the abuse, the stolen money, the long hours. She had seen all the talk shows, heard all the complaints, seen all the crocodile tears from her colleagues. And their dishonesty sickened her. Here was the truth about the child star dilemma. No, it's not the abuse. Though when Lydia was young and foolish enough to believe a shrink could help, he kept telling her how she must be blocking, that she had, in all likelihood, been molested by one of the show's producers. And no, don't blame parental neglect for what child stars become. Or, in reverse, parental pushing. It's not the lack of friends, the long hours, the poor socialization skills, the stream of studio tutors. No, it is none of that. It is, quite simply, the loss of the spotlight. Period. The rest are excuses, because no one wants to admit that they are that shallow. Lydia began working on the show when she was 6. She had few memories that dated back before then. All she remembers, thus, is being a star. A star is special. A star is royalty. A star is the closest thing on earth to a god. And for Lydia, there had never been anything else. We teach our children that they are special. But Lydia lived it. Everyone thought she was adorable. Everyone thought she was the perfect daughter, loving and kind and yet properly sassy. People stared at her with a bizarre longing. People wanted to be near her, to know about her life, spend time with her, touch the hem of her cloak. And then one day, poof, all gone. Fame is more addictive than crack. Adults who lose fame. One-hit wonders, for example, usually tailspin into depression, though they try to act like they're above it. They don't want to admit the truth. Their whole life is a lie, a desperate scramble for another dose of that most potent of drugs, fame. Those adults had a mere sip of the nectar before it was snatched away, but for a child star, that nectar is mother's milk. It's all they've ever known. They can't comprehend that it's fleeting, that it won't last. You can't explain that to a child. You can't prepare them for the inevitable. Lydia had never known anything but adulation. And then pretty much overnight, the spotlight went out. She was, for the first time in her life, alone in the dark. That was what screws you up. Lydia recognized that now. Heshi had helped her. He had gotten her off the junk once and for all. She had hurt herself, had been a slut, had snorted and shot up more narcotics than one could imagine. She did none of these things to escape. She did them to lash out, to hurt something or someone. Her mistake, she realized in rehab after a truly horrific and violent incident, was that she was hurting herself. Fame raises you up. It makes others lesser. So why on earth was she hurting the one who should be on top? Instead, why not hurt the pitiful masses? Those who had worshipped her, who had given her such heady power, who had turned on her. Why harm the superior species, the one who'd been worthy of all this praise? Lydia? I think we should call now. She turned to Heshi. They had met in the loony bin, and right away it was as if their mutual misery could reach out and embrace. Heshi had rescued her when two orderlies had pinned her down. At the time, he had merely pushed them off her. The orderlies threatened them, and they both promised not to say anything. But Heshi understood how to bide his time. He waited. 2 weeks later, he ran over one of the goons with a stolen car. While the goon lay wounded, Heshi backed up over his head, and then, positioning the tire near the base of the neck, hit the accelerator. A month later, the second goon, the lead orderly, was found in his home. Four of his fingers had been ripped off. Not cut or sliced, but twisted. The ME could tell by the rotation tears. The fingers had been rotated around and around until the tendons and bone finally snapped. Lydia still had one of the fingers somewhere in the basement. 10 years ago, they ran off together and changed their names. They altered their appearances just enough. They both started over, avenging angels, damaged but superior, above the riffraff. She didn't hurt anymore. Or at least when she did, she found an outlet. They had three residences. Heshi purportedly lived in the Bronx. She had a place in Queens. They both had working addresses and working phones. But that was all for show. Business offices, if you will. Neither of them wanted anyone to know that they were, in fact, a team. Connected. Lovers. Lydia, using an alias, had bought this bright yellow house 4 years ago. It had 2 bedrooms and 1.5 baths. The kitchen, where Heshy now sat, was airy and happy. They were on a lake in the tippy north corner of Morris County, New Jersey. It was peaceful here. They loved the sunsets. Lydia kept staring at the pictures of Pixie Trixie. She tried to remember what she'd felt like back then. The memories were pretty much gone. Heshy stood behind her now and waited with his usual patience. There were those who would claim that she and Heshy were cold-blooded killers. That, Lydia quickly realized, was pretty much a misnomer, another Hollywood creation. Like the wonderfulness of Pixie Trixie. No one enters this violent business merely because it is profitable. There are easier ways to make a living. You may act like a professional. You may keep your emotions in check. You may even delude yourself into thinking it's just another day at the office. But when you look at it honestly, the reason you walk on this wrong side of the line is because you enjoy it. Lydia understood that. Hurting someone, killing someone, fading or turning out the light in a person's eyes. No, she did not need that. She did not crave it as she had the spotlight. But yes, no question, there was that pleasant jolt, that unmistakable thrill, a lessening of her own pain. Lydia? I'm on it, Pooh Bear. She picked up the cell phone with the stolen number and the scramble. She turned and faced Heshy. He was hideous, but she didn't see that. He nodded at her. She flipped on the voice changer and dialed the number. When Lydia heard Mark Seidman's voice, she said, "Shall we try this again?" Chapter 16. Before I answered the phone, Rachel put her hand over mine. "This is a negotiation," she said. "Fear and intimidation are tools in that. You have to stay strong. If they intend to let her go, they will be flexible." I swallowed and flicked on the phone. I said hello. "Shall we try this again?" The voice had the same robotic hum. I felt a tick in my blood. I closed my eyes and said, "No." "Pardon me?" "I want assurances that Tara is alive." "You received hair samples, did you not?" "Yes." "And?" I looked over at Rachel. She nodded. The match was inconclusive. "Fine," the voice said. "I might as well hang up now." "Wait," I said. "Yes?" "You drove off last time." "So we did." "How do I know you won't do that again?" "Did you call the police this time?" "No." "Then you have nothing to worry about. Here is what I want you to do." "It's not going to work like that," I said. "What?" I could feel my body begin to quake. "We make a swap. You don't get the money until I get my daughter." "You're not in any position to bargain." "I get my daughter," I said, my words coming out slowly, dead weights. "You get your money." "It's not going to work like that." "Yes," I said, trying to force bravado into my voice. "This ends here and now. I don't want you running away again and then coming back for more. So we make an exchange and end this." "Dr. Seidman." "I'm here." "I want you to listen to me carefully." The silence was too long, straining my nerves. If I hang up now, I won't call back for another 18 months. I closed my eyes and hung on. Think about the repercussions for a moment. Aren't you wondering where your daughter has been? Aren't you wondering what will become of her? If I hang up, you won't know anything for another 18 months. It felt like a steel belt was being tightened around my chest. I couldn't breathe. I looked at Rachel. She stared back steadily, urging me to stay strong. How old would she be then, Dr. Seidman? I mean, if we keep her alive. Please. Are you ready to listen? I squeezed my eyes shut. I'm just asking for assurances. We sent you the hair samples. I bring the money. You bring my daughter. You get the money when I see her. Are you trying to dictate terms, Dr. Seidman? The robotic voice had a funny lilt now. I don't care who you are, I said. I don't care why you did any of this. I just want my daughter back. Then you'll make the drop exactly as I tell you. No, I said. Not without assurances. Dr. Seidman? Yes. Goodbye. And then the phone went dead. Chapter 17. Sanity is a thin string. Mine snapped. No, I did not scream. Just the opposite. I grew impossibly calm. I pulled the phone away from my ear and looked at it as if it had just materialized there and I had no idea what it was. Mark? I looked at Rachel. They hung up. They'll call back, she said. I shook my head. They said not for another 18 months. Rachel studied my face. Mark. Yes. I need you to listen to me closely. I waited. You did the right thing here. Thanks. Now I feel better. I've had experience with this. If Tara is still alive, and if they have any intention of giving her back, they'll give on this issue. The only reason not to make this exchange is because they don't want to or can't. Can't. The tiny part of my brain that remained rational understood that. I reminded myself of my training. Compartmentalize. So now what? We get ready, just as we planned before. I have enough equipment with me. We'll wire you up. If they call back, we'll be ready. I nodded dumbly. Okay. Meanwhile, is there anything else we can do here? Did you recognize the voice at all? Do you remember anything new about the man in flannel? About the van? Anything? No, I said. On the phone, you mentioned finding a CD in your basement. Yes. I quickly told her the story about the disc and the label reading MVD. She took out a pad and jotted down notes. Do you have the disc with you? No. Doesn't matter, she said. We're in Newark now. We might as well see what we can learn from this MVD. Chapter 18. Lydia lifted the Sig Sauer P226 into the air. I don't like how that went, she said. You made the right move, Heshi said. We cut out now. This is over. She stared at the weapon. She wanted very much to pull the trigger. Lydia? I heard you. We were doing this because it was simple.
Simple?
Yes. We thought that it would be easy money.
Lots of money.
True, he said. We can't just walk away. Heshi saw the wetness in her eyes. This was not about the money. He knew that. He's tortured either way, he said.
I know.
Think about what you just did to him, Heshi said. If he never hears from us again, he will spend the rest of his life wondering, blaming himself. She smiled.
Are you trying to turn me on?
Lydia moved onto Heshi's lap, curled into him like a kitten. He wrapped his giant arms around her, and for a moment, Lydia calmed. She felt safe and quiet. She closed her eyes. She loved the feeling. And she knew, as did he, that it would never last, that it would never be enough.
Heshi.
Yes.
I want to get that money.
I know you do.
And then I think it would be best if he died.
Heshi pulled her close. Then that's what will happen. Chapter 19. I don't know what I expected from the offices of most valuable detection. A pebbled glass door a la Sam Spade or Philip Marlowe, maybe? A soiled building of faded brick? A walk-up, for sure. A buxom secretary with a bad dye job. But the Office of Most Valuable Detection had none of that. The building was shiny and bright, part of the Urban Renewal Program of Newark. I keep hearing about Newark's renaissance, but I don't see it. Yes, there are several beautiful office buildings like this one, and a stunning performance arts center conveniently located so that those who can afford to attend, read those who don't live in Newark, can get to it without, well, driving through the city. But these sleek edifices are flowers among the weeds, scant stars in an otherwise black sky. They do not change the basic color. They do not blend or bleed. They remain removed. Their sterile beauty is not contagious. We stepped off the elevator. I still held the bag with $2 million in it. It felt weird in my hand. There were three headphone-clad receptionists behind a wall of glass. Their desk was high. We stated our names into an intercom. Rachel showed an ID that listed her as a retired FBI agent. We were buzzed in. Rachel pushed open the door. I trailed behind her. I felt empty, scooped out, but I was functioning. The horror of what had happened, the hang-up, was so great that I had pushed beyond paralysis to a strange stage of focus. Again, I compare all this to the surgery room. I enter that room, I cross that gateway, and I shed the world. I had a patient once, a 6-year-old boy who was getting a fairly routine cleft palate repair. While on the table, his vitals dropped suddenly. His heart stopped. I didn't panic. I fell into a state of focus not unlike this one. The boy pulled through. Still flashing the ID, Rachel explained that we wanted to see someone in charge. The receptionist smiled and nodded in that way people do when they aren't listening. She never took off the headphones. Her fingers pressed some buttons. Another woman appeared. She led us down the corridor and into a private office. For a moment, I couldn't tell if we were in the presence of a man or a woman. The bronze nameplate on the desk read Conrad Dorfman. Conclusion? a man. He rose theatrically. He was too slim in a blue suit with Guys and Dolls wide pinstripes, tapered at the waist so that the bottom of the jacket flared out almost enough to be mistaken for a skirt. His fingers were what one might call tapered, his hair slicked down like Julie Andrews's in Victor Victoria, and his face had a blotchy smoothness I usually associate with a cosmetic foundation. "Please," he said in a voice with too much affect, "my name is Conrad Dorfman. I'm the executive vice president of MVD. We shook his hand. He held our hands a second too long, putting the free hand over the shake and peering intently into our eyes. Conrad invited us to sit. We did. He asked us if we'd enjoy a cup of tea. Rachel, taking the lead, said that we would. There were a few more minutes of chit-chat. Conrad asked Rachel questions about her time with the FBI. Rachel was vague. She implied that she, too, worked in the private detection biz and was thus his colleague and worthy of professional courtesy. I said nothing, letting her work. There was a knock on the door. The woman who had escorted us down the corridor opened the door and wheeled in a silver tea cart. Conrad began to pour. Rachel got to the point. "We were hoping you could help us," Rachel said. "Dr. Seidman's wife was a client of yours." Conrad Dorfman concentrated on the tea. He used one of those screen door sifters that seemed all the rage nowadays. He shook out some leaves and slowly poured. "You folks provided her with a CD that's password protected. We need to get into it." Conrad handed a cup of tea to Rachel first, then me. He settled back and took a deep sip. "I'm sorry," he said. "I can't help you. The password is set by the client on their own." "The client is dead." Conrad Dorfman did not blink. "That really doesn't change anything. Her husband here is next of kin. That makes the CD his." "I wouldn't know," Conrad said. "I don't practice estate law. But we have no control over any of that. As I said before, the client sets the password. We may have given her the CD. I really can't confirm or deny that at this stage. But we would have no idea what numbers or letters she programmed in for the password." Rachel waited a beat. She stared at Conrad Dorfman. He stared back but dropped his eyes first. He picked up his tea and took another sip. "Can we find out why she came to you in the first place?" "Without a court order? No, I don't think so." "Your CD," she said. "There's a back entry." "Excuse me?" "Every company has one," Rachel said. "The info isn't lost forever. Your company programs in its own password so that you folks can get on the CD." "I don't know what you're talking about." "I used to be an FBI agent, Mr. Dorfman." "So?" "So I know these things. Please don't insult my intelligence." "That was not my intent, Ms. Mills. But I simply can't help." I looked at Rachel. She seemed to be weighing her options. "I still have friends, Mr. Dorfman, in the department. We can ask questions. We can poke around. The feds don't much like private eyes, you know that. I don't want trouble. I just want to know what's on the CD. Dorfman put down his cup. He strummed his fingers. There was a knock and the same woman opened the door. She beckoned Conrad Dorfman. He rose, again, too theatrically, and practically leapt across the floor. "Excuse me a moment." When he left the office, I looked at Rachel. She wouldn't turn toward me.
Rachel? Let's just see how it plays out, Mark.
But there really wasn't much more to play. Conrad came back into the office. He crossed the room and stood over Rachel, waiting for her to look up. She wouldn't give him the satisfaction. Our president, Malcolm DeWard, is a former federal agent himself.
Did you know that?
Rachel said nothing. He made some calls while we chatted. Conrad waited.
Ms. Mills?
Rachel finally looked up.
Your threats are impotent. You have no friends at the agency. Mr. DeWard, alas, does. Get out of my office. Now.
Chapter 20. I said, what the hell was that all about?
I told you before. I'm not an agent anymore.
What happened, Rachel? She kept her eyes forward.
You haven't been a part of my life in a long time.
There was nothing to add. Rachel drove now. I held on to the cell phone, again willing it to ring. When we arrived back at my house, dusk had settled in. We went inside. I debated calling Tickner or Regan, but what good would that do now?
We need to get that DNA checked, Rachel said. My theory might sound implausible, but does the idea of your daughter being held all this time sound any more so?
So I called Edgar. I told him that I wanted to run some additional tests on the hair. He said that would be fine. I hung up without telling him that I had already endangered the drop by enlisting the help of a former FBI agent. The less said on that, the better. Rachel called someone she knew to pick up the samples from Edgar as well as a blood sample from me. He ran a private lab, she said. We would know something within 24 to 48 hours, which would probably be, in terms of a ransom demand, too late. I settled into a chair in the den. Rachel sat on the floor. She opened her bag and pulled out wires and electronic contraptions of all sorts. Being a surgeon makes me pretty good with my hands, but when it comes to high-tech gizmos, I'm totally lost. She carefully spread the contents of the bag across the carpet, giving this action her full attention. Again, I was reminded of the way she'd do the same thing with textbooks when we were in college. She reached into the bag and pulled out a razor.
The bag of money, she said.
I handed it to her. What are you going to do? She opened it. The money was in packs. $100 bills, 50 bills to a pack, 40 packs. She grabbed a wad and slowly slipped the money out, not breaking the band around it. She cut the bills like it was a deck of cards.
What are you doing? I asked.
I'm going to cut a hole.
In the actual currency?
Yep. She did it with the straight razor. She dug out a circle about the perimeter of a silver dollar, maybe a quarter inch thick. She scanned the floor, found a black device that was about the same size, fit it into the bills. Then she put the wrapping back on it. The device was totally hidden in the middle of the money wad.
A cue logger, she said in way of explanation. It's a GPS device.
You say so. GPS stands for Global Positioning System. Put simply, it will track the money. I'll put one in the lining of the bag, too, but most criminals know about that. They usually dump the cash into a bag of their own. But with all this money, they won't have time right away to search through every pack. How small do those things come?
The cue loggers?
Yes. They can make them even thinner, but the problem is the power source. You need a battery. That's where we lose out. I need something that can travel at least 8 miles. This will do it.
And where does it go to?
You mean where do I keep track of the movements?
Yes.
Most of the time it goes to a laptop, but this is state-of-the-art.
Rachel lifted a device into the air, one I see too often in the world of medicine. In fact, I think I'm the only doctor on the planet without one.
A Palm Pilot?
Designed with a special tracking screen. I'll have it on me if I have to move. She went back to work.
What's all the other stuff? I asked.
Surveillance equipment.
I don't know how much I'll be able to use, but I'd like to put a cue logger in your shoe. I want to get a camera on the car. I'd like to see if I can hook up some fiber optics on you, but that could be riskier.
She started to organize her equipment, lost in the activity. Her eyes were down when she spoke again.
Something else I want to explain to you.
I leaned forward.
Do you remember when my parents got divorced? She asked.
Yeah, sure.
It had been when we first met.
Close as we were, we never talked about it.
I always got the impression you didn't want to.
I didn't, she said too quickly.
And I thought, neither had I.
I was selfish.
We were supposedly in love for 2 years, and yet I never so much as nudged her to open up about her parents' divorce. It was more than an impression that made me hold my tongue. I knew something dark and unhappy lay there, clawing deep inside her. I did not want to poke at it, disturb it, have it possibly turn its attention in my direction.
It was my father's fault.
I almost said something really stupid, like it's never anyone's fault, or there are two sides to every story, but a flyby of good sense kept my tongue in check.
Rachel still hadn't looked up.
My father destroyed my mother, crushed her soul.
Do you know how?
No.
He cheated on her.
She lifted her head and held my gaze. I did not look away.
It was a destructive cycle, she said.
He'd cheat, he'd get caught, he'd swear he'd never do it again. But he always did. It wormed into my mother, ate away at her. Rachel swallowed, turned back to her high-tech toys.
So when I was away in Italy and I heard you'd been with someone else, I thought of a million different things to say, but they were all meaningless. Frankly, so was what she was telling me. It explained a lot, I guess, but it was the ultimate too little too late.
I stayed where I was, not moving from the chair.
I overreacted, she said.
We were young.
I just wanted... I should have told you about this back then.
She was reaching out. I started to say something, but I pulled up short.
Too much.
Just all too much. It had been 6 hours since the ransom call. The seconds tick-ticked, a deep, painful pounding in the well of my chest. I jumped when the phone rang, but it was my regular line, not the kidnapper's cell. I picked it up. It was Lenny.
What's wrong? He said, without preamble.
I looked at Rachel. She shook her head. I nodded back that I understood.
Nothing, I said.
Your mom told me you saw Edgar in the park.
Don't worry. That old bastard will screw you. You know that.
There was no reasoning with Lenny when it came to Edgar Portman. He also might be right. I know.